Hello and welcome. Today, we're going to dive into why saving Australia's wildlife means rewriting the conservation playbook, not just tweaking it. If you've ever wondered why strategies that work in Europe or North America stumble here, this is the episode that connects the dots. Spend a week in the Kimberley and another in the English countryside, and you'll feel the difference in your bones. Australia's animals evolved for millions of years without cats, foxes, or herds of hoofed grazers. They simply didn't develop the instincts to outwit stealth predators that arrived only a couple of centuries ago. So when we import overseas solutions and expect them to hum along here, we're often fixing the wrong problem with the wrong tool. Here's the first big reality check. Endemism. Around 87% of our mammals and about 93% of our reptiles occur nowhere else on Earth. That means when a species declines in Australia, there isn't a backup population somewhere else. The margin for error is tiny, and the stakes are enormous. And the second reality is the tempo. The pace of threats has accelerated. The 2019-20 Black Summer fires likely affected around 3 billion animals. Australia has already warmed by roughly 1.47 degrees since 1910. Fire seasons are longer, droughts bite harder, and new diseases and invasive species slip into the cracks those stressors create. Integrating cultural fire and indigenous land management early in planning isn't optional anymore. It's foundational. If you're trying to figure out when and how to bring that into your program, look for the Essential 2025 Guidance on Integrating Indigenous Land Management. It's a great practical primer. Now, here's the problem most people miss. It's not a single threat. It's the way threats stack. Picture a small marsupial. First, it loses habitat. Then a hotter, drier summer pushes it to the edge. A feral cat hunts more efficiently in the simplified landscape. A disease sweeps through. A late-season fire hits. It's not one punch, it's a cascade. And if we don't stack solutions as deliberately as the threats are stacking against these species, we lose ground, even while doing lots of right things. Let me walk you through the gauntlet that makes Australia uniquely hard. First, high endemism paired with narrow niches. So many species here are tied to tiny ranges or quirky microhabitats. Think of the mountain pygmy possum, basically married to alpine boulder fields, or freshwater crayfish that live in a single river system. A small shift in temperature or flow can tip them over the edge. Second, evolutionary naivety to introduced predators. Cats and red foxes arrived recently, in evolutionary terms. Our native animals didn't evolve to deal with stealth hunters that use European predator tactics. There's strong evidence linking these predators to most of the mammal extinctions since colonization. Third, the invasive species load and the cost. We're talking well over $1 billion in economic cost since 1960, which crowds out limited conservation budgets. Ecologically, cats alone kill hundreds of millions of birds each year. Add foxes, cane toads, rabbits, deer, and invasive weeds, and you've got a pressure cooker. Fourth, climate variability, heat, and fire. Australia is a boom-bust continent. And when a bust lines up with extreme heat and fire, crucial refuges collapse. The Great Barrier Reef's repeated mass bleaching events since 2016 haven't just hurt corals, they've shaken entire food webs. Fifth, fragmented governance. National environmental laws are supposed to dovetail with 8 different state and territory systems. A 2020 independent review concluded that our main federal law, the EPBC Act, isn't stopping the decline without stronger national standards. Coordination is a daily grind, and that slows down decisive action. Sixth, scale, and logistics. Managing feral cats across a pastoral lease the size of Belgium is an entirely different challenge than dealing with urban foxes in a European city. Remote, rugged terrain sends costs skyrocketing and stretches teams to their limits. And on top of all that, disease. Chytrid fungus has taken a terrible toll on frogs. Tasmanian devils face facial tumor disease. Biosecurity here isn't an afterthought. It's a constant front line. So what actually works in this landscape? The short answer is layered, locally tuned strategies that build resilience, not just quick wins. First, build a network of safe havens, not just a single fence. Predator-free fenced reserves and islands are lifesavers for animals like bilbies, mala, and numbats. But the fence is a tool, not the finish line. The most successful programs connect multiple sites, fenced and unfenced, island and mainland. Manage genetics across them. And rehearse reintroductions into partially controlled areas. Redundancy is your friend. Western Australia's Western Shield showed that broad-scale fox control can spark rebounds in woylies and numbats. But where cat pressure stays high, gains stall. The lesson is simple. Layer controls and keep dispersal pathways open so animals can recolonize aftershocks. Second, target invasive species with layered control, not silver bullets. The best teams don't bet it all on one method. They combine aerial baiting in remote deserts, smart trap arrays along habitat edges, guardian species like Maremma dogs to protect colony nesters, and tactical exclusion fencing around critical refuges. With cane toads, we haven't cracked landscape-level control yet, but aversion training has created toad-smart northern quolls that learn to avoid poisonous prey. That's not a sledgehammer. It's a scalpel, and it's keeping local populations alive. Precision interventions, tailored to species and place, often punch above their weight. Third, design for climate volatility and fire, with cultural burning at the core. When you embed cultural burning, you don't just cut extreme fuel loads. You create a fine-grained mosaic of habitats and protect old, hollow-bearing trees that many species depend on. That's knowledge honed over millennia by Indigenous land managers across North and Southeast Australia. Add to that modern tools, animal-specific refugia maps, cool gullies, south-facing slopes, riparian ribbons, plus rapid wildlife response teams ready to move after a burn. After the Black Summer fires, agencies that had pre-identified micro-refugia for gliders, potoroos, and frogs saved months of triage. If you're looking for guidance that marries ecology and culture, track down the 2025 work on Indigenous perspectives on Australian animals. Proactive, culturally informed fire planning builds real resilience. Fourth, protect and restore habitat where it counts, not just where it's easy. Protecting the right 10% beats restoring the wrong 50. Take koalas. They were uplisted to endangered in parts of eastern Australia after years of habitat loss, disease, and fire impacts. The fix is not scattergun plantings. It's securing and reconnecting core feed trees along movement corridors, tightening clearing approvals, and making sure offsets actually deliver. You concentrate effort where it changes a population's trajectory. And all of that only works if we pay attention to logistics and governance. In remote landscapes, broad-scale control needs to be paired with realistic budgets, local employment, and long-term monitoring. That's where co-management with traditional owners isn't just respectful, it's effective. It brings deep knowledge of country, seasonality, and fire behavior into everyday decisions. And in the policy space, aligning federal and state settings around clear national standards lets practitioners spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering outcomes on the ground. If you're working in this space or just care about it, Here's a simple mental checklist I use. 1. What's endemic here, and how narrow is its niche? 2. What threats are stacking, and in what order? 3. What's my layered control plan? Predators, weeds, disease, matched to this exact landscape. 4. Where are the refuges in heat, in drought, and in fire, and how do we protect them? 5. Who are the partners, traditional owners, local communities? Pastoralists, I need at the table from day one. 6. How do we build redundancy across sites so a single disaster doesn't break the system? And 7. What's the monitoring plan that tells me early if I'm drifting off course? The good news is, when we stack solutions with the same intensity that threats stack against our wildlife, we see wins. Boilies and numbats bouncing back with combined fox and cat control. Quolls surviving in toad country thanks to aversion training. Island and fenced populations seeding reintroductions into managed open landscapes. Cultural burning creating patchy, protective mosaics that carry species through the hot, dry years. These are not hypotheticals. They're real outcomes built on hard lessons. I'll leave you with this. Australia asks us to think differently, to respect that most of its animals have nowhere else to go, and that their evolutionary playbook didn't include cats, foxes, or supercharged fire seasons. It asks us to plan for volatility, to adopt precision where sledgehammers fail, and to put Indigenous knowledge at the center, not the edge, of our work. Protect the right places, layer your defenses, build networks, not islands, and act early, because in a land this unique, delay is its own kind of threat. Thanks for listening. If this sparked ideas for your projects or your community, share it with someone who's ready to rethink how we protect Australia's remarkable wildlife.